This morning, we're going to have a big conversation about Australia's growing intergenerational divide.
People try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
That is, of course, The Who, My Generation. With the federal budget handed down and the battle lines emerging for the next election, Australia's intergenerational gap is shaping up as a major political issue. The Coalition is promising a host of sweeteners for retired voters, while Labor is promising to pump more money into education and get housing prices down. If you're a voter, well, I assume you are, there's a good chance your view of those promises will be informed by, in part, the year that you were born. So with the gaps emerging in home ownership, education and employment prospects, our business reporter will begin this conversation by taking a look at just how significant the gap is. Here's David Taylor.
It's accepted the dream of owning a home for many young Australians is now out of reach. Ben Phillips is from the Centre for Social Research with the Australian National University.
I think it's quite clear that older Australians have done very well out of the property boom, so their house prices have increased. They may have doubled or tripled or quadrupled over the last 20 or so years, whereas younger people obviously find that it's much more difficult to get into a housing market.
Figures from the policy research outfit, the Grattan Institute, back that up. John Daly is the chief executive.
We've become a country in which it used to be that as a young person, whether you owned your own home or not, essentially didn't matter about your income, didn't matter. Whereas today, we're a society which is very highly divided. Those on low incomes, who are between 25 and 34, very little chance of owning their own home. Those on higher incomes, much, much more likely to own their own home.
John Daly says rising property values have led to an unprecedented wealth boost for older Australians with access to capital.
So the average household in Australia, older household, effectively was getting a wealth boost every year of about $60,000. And that's a free kick that the younger generation will not get. And instead, they are much more part of a generation which, if they want to be wealthy, basically they need to have the right parents.
Andrew Inwood heads up data crunching firm Core Data Research. He also spends his days researching the different worlds older and younger Australians face. In addition to housing affordability and building wealth, he worries a lot about young people in insecure work.
A lot of people are falling into what's been called the gig economy, where they've got kind of permanent but part-time work. So that doesn't allow them to borrow or to enter the housing market in the same way.
And as for how that affects young Australians' superannuation, forget about it, says Andrew Inwood.
Those people who are inside the gig economy, that have small jobs, tending to move from place to place, don't have great superannuation, and it will never make a big difference to their outcomes. It's the people who miss super or miss the opportunity to participate in it which are going to suffer.
And that leads to another critical generational divide, employment opportunities. Youth unemployment is currently 12.5%, more than double the national average. John Policell is an education and training expert with the University of Melbourne.
If you're looking at the kids who have struggled at school, who are low achievers, those are the kids whose achievement means they're much less likely to go to university. So that's the group that's going to end up in this more vulnerable situation.
In generations gone by, says Professor Policell, it was easier.
In the past, completion of Year 12 was regarded as a fairly significant achievement, so that pathway from school, from Year 12, straight into that kind of, you know, well-paid, skilled work with some kind of future ahead of it, that's been closed off.
So while it does seem harder for younger Australians to get ahead in life now, lacking full-time job opportunities and the access to assets that comes with that, the ANU's Ben Phillips throws a spanner in the works, arguing while all that is true, it masks the fact that the younger generation still has plenty of cash to burn. In fact, he goes so far as to say that the younger generation is the wealthiest young generation Australia has seen.
Look, I think there's certainly challenges in terms of purchasing a house, but certainly in terms of incomes, you'll still find that the younger generation, say those under 35 today, have certainly have higher incomes than, say, generations in years gone by, and that's simply because the country as a whole has got a much higher living standard, and that's percolated to all different groups in society. So they're probably doing better than what younger generation was doing 20 years ago. And ultimately, I still think they have a higher living standard than, say, young people of 30 or 40 years ago.
So whether you see younger or older Australians as being better off, most would agree the generational divide creates opportunities for politicians to fish for votes. As political commentator Peter Van Onselen explains.
It's a generational war that the government are hoping to create in political terms here. Baby boomers are a really big cohort who have started to hit retirement age. They have a lot of concessions, which a lot of economists tell us in the longer term will have to be addressed. In the short term, the government is hoping politically that some of the pain of closing down those loopholes or closing down those concessions will bite at Labor. And that's what the government's banking on. They're banking on being able to really get those voters back, many of whom they lost around their own super reforms, for example. You see this, you know, I mean, I see it in my own family, you know, the generational arguments that are happening between sort of parents and children over this side of things, that there is that looming issue. I think it'll be even stronger in 10 years from now.
Yeah, we've all had those conversations, haven't we? That's journalist and professor of politics, Peter Van Onselen, speaking on this program last week. And that report was put together by our business reporter, David Taylor. So we're going to discuss this now, the generational gap, how that might even shape the next election. I'm joined by a panel today. Alice Workman is the political reporter at BuzzFeed News. Stephen Kokoulis is the managing director of Market Economics, a former economic advisor to Julia Gillard. He's been writing on this very topic. And Anne Evans is an associate professor at the Australian National University School of Demography. Welcome, all of you, to RN Breakfast.
Good morning, Hamish.
Good morning.
Anne Evans, could I start with you just to put a bit of definition around this? When we talk about an intergenerational divide, we're not really just talking about millennials versus baby boomers, as this conversation often tends to be framed.
No, certainly not. The generations are often described in terms of birth cohorts when people are born, which is, you know, the baby boomers, the millennials, Gen X, Gen Y. But really here we're talking about, you know, different access to the wealth of Australia for people in different situations. So it's really a story of inequality and the way that inequality has played out over history, which has put people into the positions that they are today.
And is there a clear story that the demographics tell us in terms of this division that is, we're told, growing?
Well, there is a story. So one of the things that you've seen is we had a big fertility increase in the 50s. A lot of people were getting married. A lot of people were having children. And this is where the birth of the baby boomers come in. This is when they were born. So the baby boomers actually had fewer children than their parents. And they're the kids born in the 70s, the late 60s and the early 70s. So they had fewer children. So you've got this big cohort of people who have, you know, a smaller number of children. And those people born in the 70s have had, you know, also had a small number of children, and they've delayed having their children. So again, you've got a decrease in fertility that's gone on. Fertility has increased over the last couple of years, but those patterns of history have seen, you know, a shrinking of different cohorts as we go through time.
So, Alice Workman, budgets often tell us a story as well, and that's a story of priorities. Mm. What are the political parties telling us about how they view this intergenerational divide through the way in which they allocate and make decisions around our national finances?
Well, there was not a lot in this year's budget for people under 35. I think they're there. I think, you know, we like to talk about the forgotten generations. Peter Costello thought it was people earning over $200,000, but no, I actually think it's people under 35. And remember, millennials in 2018 are people aged between 22 and 37. And if you consider this year's budget what it was, which is a pre-election budget, and the coalition's basic pitch to swinging voters and people that they lost at the last election, people they want to vote for them, then I think that they really don't give a shit about millennials and they don't want them to vote for them, because there were 64,000 extra young people added to the electoral rolls because of the government's postal survey on same-sex marriage we all had to endure last year. And look, there's just not much in the budget for them. And I think that's quite an interesting strategy by the government, especially considering the Labor Party in their budget reply came out and actually had a few quite interesting policies pitched at young people around higher education and TAFE and social issues to do with climate change. Scott Morrison said, I think quite proudly in his budget night speech, that the government weren't going to do anything more about climate change. And that's really shaping up to be an issue that my generation are going to inherit debt on. I think that's one of the bigger issues of intergenerational debt that we talk about between the generational divide. But, you know, if we're looking at millennials as a general concept, which is quite difficult when we're talking about people with an age span from 22 to 37, you know, millennials are probably the most educated, the most diverse, the most bilingual, multicultural, most globally in touch generation that has ever existed. But at the same time, they're also the generation that are inheriting the biggest debt. And I don't just mean debt from previous generations, but I mean that they start their life off with a huge amount of debt from when they graduate university. So when they're in their early 20s, they've already got a HECS debt of a couple of thousand. For some people, if they're doing multiple degrees, tens of thousand dollars. But, you know, the millennials have also been locked out of the housing market. It takes them a lot longer to buy a house than other generations. You know, we have stagnant wage growth. The government's plan for tax also means that uni grads earning $60,000 a year will be hit with the same amount of tax as people earning $200,000 a year in 7 years' time if they get re-elected. But, you know, young people also get hit by levies, Medicare levies, banking levies, all these other kind of levies that other generations get hit with. So I think that and of course, penalty rates. Let me not forget to talk about penalty rates. My point is just that I think that I was listening to the package saying that the younger Australians are better off than any other Australians. That could be true in terms of a cost of living, cost of lifestyle kind of issue, but I think that there are also big debts that get put on younger people and that we shouldn't forget that when we're talking about intergenerational debt.
All right. Stephen Koukoulas, do you agree with this idea that the political parties are sharpening their focus around an intergenerational divide and are planning to fight an election on those demographic differences?
Look, I think so, that Alice touched on some very good points there, but if I can sort of bring it back to sort of three critical issues that I can see where there's a policy difference coming up at the election and that are, well, they're broad inequality issues, but they're also the intergenerational inequality. And the first one, I suppose, is education, that while young people do have a terrific access to finishing year 12, going to university, getting a great education and giving them an opportunity to get a wonderful job, they are saddled with university debt. And we do not want to go down the path of the US experience where many people still in their 40s and 50s have such a high level of debt that they can't spend. It's actually a macroeconomic problem in the US economy. So with Labor promising not to hike fees to the same extent as the coalition, I think that's one issue there. The other one, of course, is superannuation, which for young people who in their 20s and probably their 30s don't really give a damn about how much money they've got in there because retirement is such a long, long, long way away. But for those of us who are older, with these incredibly generous tax concessions for superannuation, it is actually allocating cash to older people close to retirement, if not in retirement, and that's a huge cost to the budget, which means there's less money to be spent elsewhere. And of course, the other one is housing as the third important issue. And on that one, I think it's the negative gearing changes that Labor are proposing, and of course, they've been proposing those for the last 2 or 3 years, certainly prior to the 2016 election, that they're wanting to ensure that people who do negative gear properties, and they tend to be high-income earners, they tend to be older people, they tend to freeze other people out of the housing market. That policy change alone will be, in a funny way, an intergenerational benefit that improves housing affordability if it comes to pass.
We're getting lots of messages in via Facebook, Twitter and on the text line. Stella Burnell says, as a baby boomer, I'm sick of being blamed for the woes of the world. Life wasn't a doddle for any of us, but somehow every bad thing that happens these days is blamed on my generation who supposedly had it so easy. Alice Workman, I can see through our cameras there in camera, you throwing your hands back in the air. I mean, that is very much the narrative that exists, isn't it, from the baby boomer generation, if you like, when it comes to the complaints of the generation that you and I belong to.
Sure, but the baby boomer generation and the baby boomer politicians need to frankly own up to the policy decisions and the spending decisions that they've made. If look at something like the NBN, the government have chosen to roll out an NBN, which, I mean, is problematic from the day dot, but they've chosen to roll out old technology that will be outdated so quickly that millions and millions more will have to be spent on fixing it up by the next generation that comes into power. And also look at projects like the NDIS, which the government have refused to cost properly. These are all problems caused by the baby boomer generation who, you know, may be able to look 7 years into the future to give themselves a tax cut, but they can't look into the future to make decisions for future-proofing, which is one of the favourite terms the Liberals like to throw around, but frankly, I don't think they actually ever do properly.
Stephen Kukulis, is that really what's happening?
Look, I like to think that the degree of toughness that we've all lived through when I was young or now that I'm older, there are different pressures that have been on us. I mentioned before that back in the day in the 70s, only 3% of people went to university and only 30% finished year 12. Imagine those sorts of figures now. So the access to university is a wonderful thing, albeit at the cost of people accumulating university debt. Similar with housing. That housing is an issue that in the olden days, if you like, that the house that you bought for $50,000 at only a multiple of two or three times your wage was relatively cheap. It was cheap. However, you had to pay 17% interest rates. You couldn't get the credit from the bank because there were quantitative restrictions. So, look, it's sort of to say that every generation faces some difficulties. They're just that the difficulties change from time to time, and cherry picking low house prices versus high interest rates in that example of housing from two or three decades ago.
Well, to give you a real world housing example, my parents bought their house, which is in the southern suburbs of Sydney, for $75,000 in 1975. That type of house now, which is a four bedroom house, is worth nearly $2 million.
Yeah.
That is just, and they bought it when they were out of university. My mum was a teacher. My dad was still studying, actually. And that is just something that is unaffordable for people of my age this day. There's no way that I could buy a house in the suburbs.
So what's the solution? I'm not sure what the solution is then. Do we try to engineer house prices falling in half? Because that was the consequence of what happened in places like Ireland and Spain, and they've had 20% unemployment as a result of trying to address house price problems through
crashing
prices.
No, that's true. But New Zealanders has just banned foreign ownership.
Yep.
All right. And can I draw you into this part of the conversation? Because as we're hearing, being in your 20s or 30s now is very different to being in your 20s or 30s a few decades ago. How have priorities for young people changed?
Well, I think the priorities of young people are, in a sense, still the same. Everyone wants to, you know, get a job, get, you know, have their life, have relationships. Young people now have a lot more freedom, I think, in the way that they can structure their early adulthood. There's an extended period in education. There's a lot more access to travel now within Australia and internationally than there was in the past. One of the things demographically, I suppose, that you have this interplay between generations is the caring side. So, you know, we've got a lot of people in the older ages. The proportion of people over 65 is growing. It's going to continue to grow. The proportion of people over 85 is also growing. And these are people who are going to be in a situation where they need care. And that care can only come from the younger people, the millennials, who are the people coming into the workforce, are not necessarily coming into the kinds of jobs that are going to be useful for the older generation in those caring roles. There's also, you know, the issue of caring for younger people. So there's another generation behind as well that we can't forget, you know, the small kids, the babies who need childcare and early primary education. So, you know, we've got to think also about the structure of the workforce so that the people who are in the workforce are being able to provide income through taxes, but also to be in those kinds of professions that are going to provide care for the older and the younger ages. And this is, I suppose, where immigration comes into this debate as well. So the government has, you know, quite tough policies and structures around immigration so that we bring in the kinds of skills that we need in the country. And those skills are going to more and more be in the areas of caring and healthcare.
An interesting text from someone predating the baby boomer generation this morning, a tweet rather, saying the whole debate completely ignores those of us who remember World War II, 15 years of rationing, virtually no access to university in favour of these boomers who just had a dream elevator run. Like it or not, there were a significant number of young people who signed up to the electoral roll during the same-sex marriage postal survey, 90,000 of them, in fact. And is that likely to have a big influence, all these new young people on the register at the next election?
Well, I wonder what kind of impact it's going to have. You know, these people are now registered to vote. Whether they will vote is you know, another question. So the same-sex marriage survey was something that they were passionate about and wanted to actually have their voice recorded. But we know that the fact that they weren't on the electoral roll before, that they weren't, you know, they weren't really interested or engaged in having their voice recorded before that. So I think it will have an impact. What kinds of things young people will be voting for is quite interesting. They do tend to be more interested in environmental issues and issues of inequality and fairness than perhaps the predecessors might have been.
There, interestingly, to that point, Labor leader Bill Shorten made a direct appeal to young voters in the budget response. We've got a bit of that audio here from him speaking after the budget. Here it is.
Young Australians deserve better, so tonight I promise young Australians, Labor will create a level playing field for first home buyers, because I don't want us to live in a country where your only chance of owning a home is to inherit one. We're serious too about tackling climate change and helping the environment.
Alice Workman, I mean, does that sort of thing do enough, do you think, to win over younger voters?
Well, I think I spoke to a lot of people after the budget week, and I think that they were just happy that someone was speaking to younger people, given the coalition's kind of reluctance to even acknowledge that they are eligible voters. Especially the stuff about TAFE. The government made a lot of changes to how TAFE works, including changing a lot of things that were previously grants into loans and defunding a couple of TAFE programs. And so the Labor Party have turned around and said that they're going to change that and make some TAFE programs free, which I think appeals to, I think it really speaks to a lot of people.
Stephen Koukoulis, as more of these baby boomers move into retirement age, I mean, they're sort of at the point, many of them, where they have just retired or are moving towards that, and I suppose we should note that many of them are working longer. Is the fact that many of them will be out of work going to really shape our politics in a bigger way in the future?
Look, you've made a very good point that the workforce participation rate of people aged 65 and over has almost tripled in the last 10 years. So people are working longer, partly because they're living longer, so that's a good thing. But I suspect a lot of it's due to the fact that they are retiring with inadequate savings, that they're needing to sort of stay in employment. Now, that's a question, that's a big macroeconomic question. Some people are saying that the fact that they're staying in work is freezing out job opportunities for other younger people. My feeling on that would be, well, actually, it's probably a function of the economy just not growing fast enough, that everybody who wants a job should have a job, and you need a strong, vibrant, dynamic economy for that to occur. And we currently don't have that you look at the budget, you look at what the Reserve Bank's doing on monetary policy, and no one's really put their foot on the accelerator to try to kickstart the economy, to get unemployment down to a level well below 5%, to allow wages to pick up, to allow for consumer spending and housing affordability to improve. So I think that's a bigger overarching problem, just that we've sort of stuck in this post-GFC funk with very sluggish moderate growth.
But it's interesting, I think the older Australians that aren't benefiting off franking credits also get a little bit of help from the government, because the Abbott and the Turnbull governments provide incentives, so they will pay employers to a higher older Australians over younger Australians, which, you know, I think that we'll probably see more of in the future.
A tweet from Bronwyn says, baby boomers gave women greater equality, fought homophobia, racism, the Vietnam War. Intergenerational discussions tend to be blame games. I think the blame games bit is probably a fair point because that is the tenor of how this conversation most often unfolds. Stephen Koukoulas, if you can wrap us up here because we're hitting the news time at 8:30, is there a way to solve these problems without it becoming a big battle between these generations?
Yeah, I would sort of summarise it by saying that there is an inequality issue. There are old people who are doing very poorly. There are some young people who are swimming in money. So it's not just an intergenerational issue. There is an inequality issue between the haves and the have-nots, if you like. So policies that address, and it's not to say that you can't tackle each of them. The intergenerational one can be tackled through, you know, education is the standout one, making it affordable and accessible and TAFE and the like, but also ensuring that everybody has a decent safety net in their income level. And that's sort of the expensive, difficult political problem that we'll be arguing about when the election campaign hots up.
Well, we got through this without even a mention of avocado on toast. Anne Evans, Stephen.
I know that's your favourite breakfast, Hamish. Don't lie.
Anne Evans, Stephen Koukoulas and Alice Workman, thank you so much. The reaction from the RN audience to this conversation this morning has been overwhelmingly positive and very, very engaged. So thank you so much to all three of you.
Thanks,
Hamish.